and welcome to Fundraising as a Female Founder, the podcast all about how to raise funds for your business as a woman. I'm your host, Alice Audley. With less than 1p in every pound of venture capital investment going to all female-founded companies, it's time to start asking some very hard questions about the fundraising landscape. On this podcast, I will speak to women who have either raised money, are raising money, are an angel, work in venture capital, or work within companies' investment teams, and get their views, advice, and lessons about how to successfully raise funds as a female founder. Who knows, I may speak to a couple of men who have invested in female-led companies too. So without further ado, you're listening to Fundraising as a Female Founder. I hope you enjoy the series. Today on Fundraising as a Female Founder, I'm joined by Stevie Spring, CBE, who is a portfolio director, investor, and PE advisor. Stevie chairs both the British Council and Mind, is a non-executive director and chairman of remuneration for the Cooperative Group, and chairs Tech Scale-Up, Kinomo.
I'm Stevie Spring. Currently, I am the chairman of the British Council, which is a $1.5 billion-ish turnover business that operates in over 100 countries with about 15,000 colleagues. It's an arm's length branch of the Foreign Office, and it's a profit with purpose business, building relationships around the world through arts and culture and education and skills. I am also the chairman of Mind, a mental health charity, which also has 170 shops as part of our fundraise. So again, another profit with purpose organisation. I am on the main board of the Cooperative Group, which is a 10 billion turnover food, funerals, insurance, pharmacy group with 85,000 colleagues. And again, a profit with purpose organisation, the largest consumer cooperative in the world. It's not a startup anymore, it's a scale-up called Kinomo, which is a 3D imagery company founded out of Minsk.
That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff. Aren't I lucky?
Can we take a look back at your career and how you got to where you are? What does your career history look like? Where did you start?
Lawyer turned marketeer turned television, advertising, ended up as CEO of two international media groups. So I particularly like the Guardian description of media grandee. And in 2012, I, inverted commas, went portfolio and started to do a number of non-exec functions. But throughout my career, I've had a dual track commercial and not-for-profit career. So the commercial career we just went through, but literally my first job was at 16 as a waitress. And at the same time, I was involved with a not-for-profit called FAB at the time, Physically Handicapped and Able-Bodied. And ever since then, I have always done not-for-profit roles as well, non-stop. I became chairman of the Groundwork Federation in, 99. And then I did a decade of being chairman of BBC Children in Need. So I've always worked for people-based not-for-profits as well.
You're obviously an incredibly powerful woman. What does it mean for you, like, women in business in 2020, and how has the role of women within the workplace changed during your time working?
Well, I think it has changed in that, we're starting to see women in senior positions at scale. I think what hasn't changed is, we are going to get the numbers wrong, but we're over 50 years away from the Equal Pay Act, and we're probably 100 years away from equal pay, not because of a gender pay gap, but partly because of a gender role gap. There are just fewer women in the most senior positions that earn really serious money. But more importantly, women, traditionally women's roles, caring professions, even some teaching professions, support functions, which traditionally have been done by women, nursing, care workers, social workers, etc., earn less than the ability to lift a heavy box or traditional male jobs. And because the largest employer of those caring jobs is the government, reframing the reward structure for those types of jobs would literally bankrupt the country. So we need to think very differently about how we value different roles, in my view, to make the biggest difference to the most women.
Yeah.
When we talk about gender change in the workplace, it tends to be at the senior end of the spectrum rather than the mass end of the spectrum. And I think it's really important that we concentrate on both.
That's very interesting. Have you encountered gender bias during your career? And do you have any memorable moments that stick out to you?
Far too many. So some of them were self-inflicted. For many, many years, I would wear vertiginous heels because I am 5 foot four and a half, and the half is really important. So I thought if I didn't have height, I lacked stature and authority. And I remember once saying that to a male colleague who just laughed out loud and thought that was hilarious, but it wasn't at the time. I remember having a Me Too moment with a client in an agency that was uncomfortable and inappropriate. And when I went in the next day and said to my managing director what had happened, how uncomfortable I was, and I expected the answer to be, you know, we will complain to the company, we'll get this sorted. I got, oh, Stevie, when will you learn that you're not coming to work to get new boyfriends? And I was moved off the account, and a bloke put on it, you know, sort of inappropriate stuff like that, you know, meetings held in gentlemen's clubs, the golfing circuit, you know, a lot of work done after hours in the pub that if you don't join in, you feel out of the loop. So presenteeism was very big. I think it is softening at the top. I think it's liberating for men as well, frankly. But we've still got a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, even now, some of my contemporary male friends that are raising funds, they'll have a first kind of meeting with a prospective investor in the pub in the evening, and it is more relaxed and, you know, but men don't feel comfortable asking a woman into that environment and sort of having beers with the woman. So it's more formal, and it's just you're getting them at a different part of the day.
Yeah.
And I think when you're networking, it's often better when it is a bit more relaxed.
And I think that, you know, the unintended consequences of, inverted commas, the backlash, and I think it will soften, is, you know, men are very worried about mentoring or sponsoring younger women. They are very fearful of one-on-one social time in a way that they're not with a male counterpart. It shouldn't matter, except, of course, the power balance is still, you know, we all know more men called Dave or John running FTSE companies than there are women, etc., etc. So for the power balance to start to shift, we do still need male sponsors and male mentors at a time when there is a reticence to be seen to have an inappropriate agenda.
Mm.
So I think that's right. I do.
So in business, we're talking about, obviously this podcast is fundraising as a female founder. There was an article in the FT last year that was saying that women receive one penny on the pound compared to men. What are your views on the fundraising landscape as a woman?
I think that men know, and I'm making broad generalisations here, because of course the world doesn't divide into two, and there is many differences between their sexes or genders as there are intra or inter. So you know, wild generalisations. I think that men understand the game better. They understand that when you're talking to a funder, they are looking at a spreadsheet of probability. They want to talk the language of investment returns. They want to talk the language of risk. They want to talk the language of leaving something on the table for the next iteration. Financial manipulation spreadsheets. Women, again, generalization, want to talk rich ideas and possibilities, and very frequently are pushed into a fluffy bunny box because they're not coming over as hard-nosed spreadsheet manipulators and financial engineers.
When they
certainly private equity is a spreadsheet manipulation. You know, if I invest here, I leverage up to there, I'll exit there, I'll get 80% of the upside. VC is a, you know, I'm going to spread invest. I'm going to back the person as much as the idea, and backing the person as much as the idea is about shortening the odds. Have they done it before? Have they got a success story? Do they understand the fundamentals? Have they got an eye on the money? Are they in an area of such high growth that even if I don't get to profit, I'll be able to get to an exit? And angel investor is slightly different because it's invariably people who already love and trust you and are investing in you, almost regardless of what you're bringing them. I mean, again, exaggerating to make the point. And the last element that I think is worth talking about is crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, because that's people taking a punt and having a bit of fun. But you can raise quite serious amounts of money by doing that. And a lot of venture funds, you know, watch crowdfunding to see what happens quickly. And it's almost the wisdom of crowds. Oh my God, if everybody's piling into that, that looks like a good idea. Maybe I should take a stake.
With venture capital, you mentioned it's more on the person and the vision and a bit of the spreadsheet too. There are quite a few studies on women presenting themselves and those characteristics. I think there was one that was quoted in Lean In, that, don't hold me to this, but I think it was Harvard Business School. And the students, there were 60 of them, they were given, split into the 30, then given a CV. The CVs were identical.
Blind.
Apart from one was called Heidi and one was called Howard, and then they had to say what it would be like to work for that person. And with Heidi, it was bossy, she sounds difficult.
Yeah, yeah. That's slightly different. That's who you're working with and for. And there is still a lens that says, my ambition is your sharp elbows. My decisiveness is your bossiness. My passion is your volatility. Many, many, many traits of leaders, as opposed to managers, are seen through a masculine lens, which when you put them on a woman who historically has to be liked, soft,
self-deprecating,
gentle, self-deprecating, all of those issues can unconsciously feel wrong or inappropriate in a woman. And I think it is becoming slightly less, but if somebody is looking to criticise, they do it through that gender lens, and that can be very uncomfortable.
As a media grandee, we didn't sort of touch upon kind of institutional investors and strategic investment. During your time within the media corporations, did you have lots of kind of people pitching to you to sort of either invest in them or acquire them? And what does a kind of strategic look like? And when should one consider that, do you think?
So I've spent a lot of time being both pitcher and pitchy. When, you know, it's like any salesmanship, really. When people come to you for investment or for cash of any description, you're buying them first. You know, whether we like it or not, first impressions count. Especially if it's somebody you don't know. Am I going to trust this person with my money and my vision? The amount of homework you've done, does it, you know, if you're making a strategic pitch, where does it fit? Where does it take the company? Have you done the homework in what the corporate vision is, what the corporate purpose is, how it fits with that, how it could take the company in a slightly different way, where the synergies are, where 1 + 1 = 3. I think an understanding of cash is king, and whether you are investing as a, inverted commas, growth stock, whether you are going to be an investment which is, you know, may not be throwing off cash, but has growth potential that means that the multiple that you can get in a relatively short-term exit and somebody else takes it to profit, you know, where are you in the growth stage of that investment? It could be an acqui-hire. These are fantastic people who are working in an adjacent business. I actually want to hire the people as much as get the business. So I'm prepared to buy them through the business. You know, that's a very, very common way of establish legacy businesses, buying talent. Is it an investment that I'm going to fold into another division that will make a transformation of the existing business? So I think where you fit in the landscape of the strategic investor is a very important part, and there is no substitute for homework. It's like, you know, doing an exam and cramming to answer 10 questions, even if you only answer one. The confidence you get from understanding the perspective of the person sitting the other side of the table is incalculable.
Sometimes to get that first meeting, you'll need to kind of send over your investment deck. What makes a good investment deck, in your opinion? And what are the big no-nos?
Short. You have to understand that the investment deck is to get a meeting, it's not to get a check. So I think one of the problems is potential companies tend to try and do a one-stop sell. It's not, it's a teaser. So I think recognizing that it's a teaser is really important. You're trying to whet the appetite. You're trying to get the potential investor to want to know more. Always, you need to have some competitive tension in there. People always want a piece of what somebody else wants. So on a sort of supply and demand basis, what you don't want to look is desperate, because you have no agency then. And I think, you know, a really solid good idea, obviously, but the world isn't short of good ideas. It's short of good implementers. So anything that you can do on proof of implementation to de-risk it. And then, you know, where it might fit in the broader landscape going forward. You know, it's a bit like, it's pitching anything. It's like pitching a film. You know, the starting point is always, oh, this is just like Star Wars. Or the comparator group is always, you know, imagine Facebook for, imagine Instagram for, imagine a platform for.
To create that sense of urgency that you were talking about, do you think that it's a wise decision ahead of fundraising to really kind of have your 2 months, your 3 months, and this is when I'm going to have my meetings, as opposed to sort of being in a permanent state of fundraising?
I do. Yeah. I do. And I think if you know, we all, when we've been here, underestimate how much money we're going to need. And I think women in particular go for the lowest number rather than the highest, because you sort of think it's easier. Again, in any sense of salesmanship, it's as hard to get 10 million as it is to get a million. And underfunding and continuous fundraising is exhausting, stressful, and takes your eye off the ball. Because actually what you want to be doing...
is running the business.
Is running the business.
Mm. Do you think women do the same thing with valuations of the businesses? So that...
Well, valuation...
Yeah, what are your views on valuations?
Yeah, so I feel quite strongly about this. Value, the value of the business versus the valuation of the business are two different things. And the values of the business is a third. So I think the values of the business are important and should be important increasingly to investors. The value of the business is different to each investor and in a different period of time. So in the same way as if you are hiring somebody, you know, they have a worth to that organisation doing that job at that time and where they fit into the broader scale of things. Nobody has an absolute value. You know, you can go from being a CEO of a company to a teacher, same person, same skill set, but, you know, a hundredth of the value, inverted commas. So I think valuations, particularly in startup or venture, are largely academic, frankly.
Do you think we've been looking at America a bit too much?
They're a punt. Well, you know, in a way, they are a reflection of a sea of capital looking for a home. Supply and demand. At the moment, there is an oversupply. Why? Because interest rates are so low. So I want to put my capital to work, and there is a tsunami of cash looking for a home. That pumps valuations up. The value of anything is only the price that somebody is prepared to pay for it at any one time. And, you know, clever financial engineering means that depending on the way that you put money in, a loan note, equity, all of the different arrangements and where you are in the hierarchy is important. And the most sophisticated investors will double down and protect.
Would you advise people to bring their financial directors, if they have one at that stage, to the first meeting?
Or always.
To... Really?
Always, sadly.
But then do you think they'll get bogged down in the numbers as opposed to the vision?
No, I don't. When I was a first-time PLC CEO and I was going to investor meetings, I purposefully said to the finance director, you will not answer any financial question unless I ask you to. Not because you're not brilliant, but because if I don't answer the financial questions, I will be sidelined as the fluffy bunny, pink, you know, strategy and marketing and vision and values.
Yeah.
And you will be the hard-nosed business. So if somebody asks you what the effective tax rate is, I am going to answer that.
So do you think, say, a female founder is going in and having that pitch and they're not the financial person, they should have the financial person there but be answering the questions first? And
I don't think you necessarily have to answer the questions first, but quite often in a startup situation, we don't invest or partner with a financial partner early enough. It's very, very, very important to have somebody in control of cash. Is what kills businesses. Businesses die because they run out of cash.
So, would you...
And having somebody strong managing, and it could be the founder, but most usually the founder is the vision, the idea, and the accelerator, and the finance director is the pragmatic brake. And it's very reassuring when you put your money into a company. It doesn't have to be a full-time finance director. Could be your non-exec chairman, it could be your non... But you need somebody there to reassure that you know, we're not 1999 first wave, we're going to pile money into startup land and they're going to blow it all on a single spot in the Super Bowl.
Mm. 5 million.
For instance.
Yeah. You talked about women often going out and raising less money than, and things always costing more than you anticipate.
You should ask for as much as you humanly can,
right,
without laughing.
Okay. So percentage-wise, more than you think you need, you'd be...
Always.
Yeah.
Because whatever you think you need, your costs will... If you think your costs are going to be somewhere between 15 and 20, and your revenues are going to be somewhere between 15 and 20, sure, as night follows day, the costs will be 20 and the revenues will be 15.
With the raising more than you need as one form of advice, what would your other say?
Well, I don't think it is raise more than you need. I think it's be realistic about what you need.
Okay.
Because you think, oh, I might be able to get by on 500,000 for the next year. Quote, I might be able to get by, so let me ask for 500,000. Actually, what you want is a clear runway. And actually, if I raise a million, that might see me through 2 years, but it will definitely see me through the first year.
On the use of funds in an investment deck, if you are saying that you need X amount, would the investor want to see the funds that you're raising and a breakdown of exactly what they're being used on? And in that case, if you do have a bit of contingency, you say you're going to hire X amount of staff, but actually you think maybe you need 5 rather than 10, and just keep that money in the bank later.
Well, I think what you do is spread it across. You know, you haven't... In most businesses, unless they're manufacturing, that's slightly different. You know, I want this much for stock. I want this much for IT development. I want this much for people. You know, front of house salespeople. You know, you can pretty much estimate that if I spend, you know, 50 grand, and I mean all up, which means that you're probably paying 25 grand salary, if I have a 50 grand's worth of salesman, I am going to put on 150 grand's worth of sales. I think where a lot of funders and indeed businesses flounder is if you are not intrinsically techie. Quite often, when you're looking at tech development, you have no clue. On a scale of it's going to cost 30 grand and take 3 months, or £3 million and take 3 years, where you are on that development and investment spectrum.
That roadmap, yeah.
And increasingly, of course, we're all doing iterative, do and learn. But, you know, famously in the Facebook movie, when's it going to be finished? Never. So we always underestimate how much we're going to have to invest in tech development. Mm-hmm. People costs are easier, but, you know, in small businesses, coping with absence, coping with sickness leave, coping with bumps in the road, coping with hires that don't work out, all of those things need a comfort blanket wrapped around them.
In terms of what people are investing in at the moment, I mean, with venture capital, it is mainly
just... Anything that's platformed.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. When you have, say, a media company that has different strands to it, do you think that strategic investment there is probably a more likely route than going venture capital? And why, and why not?
Well, the easiest answer is say yes, because if you're investing in a company that understands the core of your operation, but you're just delivering it slightly differently, it's always easier because you have a shorthand. That said, a bit like the movie pitch, you know, let's take Blogosphere, for example. If you're going into potential funders and you are going, you know, imagine we are a bit like a, insert successful company here, so we're a bit like a mini Informer. You know, we're a media and events company, but we don't have all of physical legacy hangover, we're flexible,
we've got the trust of the new generation.
Yes, we influence the influencers. So I think by putting it into context, you can have inverted commas cold discussions, but you are responsible for what they hear and you have to put it into context. You know, imagine a XYZ company, but without all the baggage of the physicality, for instance.
And see how much we've already done with this team. Imagine if you supercharged it, what it could be.
Exactly. And turbocharging growth is an important part of it. And also showing where you've pivoted. You know, we started as X, we have learnt Y, we are now Z. We want to turbocharge Z. So you've already learnt the lessons and they benefit from the investment that you've made in the lessons you've already learnt. Because none of the successful, inverted commas, companies that we look at in the new space are doing what they started off doing. Yeah. Amazon isn't selling books. You know, Facebook isn't telling frat house boys who the most attractive girl is.
Twitch, that was Twitch, probably just
exactly.
In TV. Yeah.
So if you look back on, and I might be exaggerating, but I don't think I am, any of the businesses that we now look at as successful. You know, Netflix started with physical videos.
My final question is two-part. What do you think that we're going to see in female-founded businesses over the next few years, and what would you like to see?
I would like to see female-founded businesses founded for a positive reason rather than a negative one. So moving towards rather than running away from. And a lot of the female founders that I speak to, not necessarily about funding, are, I fell out of the workforce because. So stuff it, I'm going to bake pies, make soap, do whatever. So it's a, they're responding to a negative rather than positive. So I would like female founders to be looking at running their own business and backing their own ideas as a positive way rather than an escape from.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. So I would like it to be a positive choice, not necessarily a...
From despair, from excitement rather than despair.
Yes, exactly right. So that's the first thing I would like to see. The second thing I would like to see is confidence. I would like women to back themselves financially in the same way that men do, which is largely OPM. You know, other people's money.
Yeah.
Is what men largely use, and my own money, friends and family. You know, if I'm not backing myself, if I'm not mortgaged up to the hilt, if I'm not paying myself 20 grand a year rather than 200, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a huge thing with female-founded businesses, that they're far more likely to put their own money in.
And to not pay themselves.
Yeah.
Yes. So those are the two things that I would like to see.
And then what
different.
Do you think we're going to see as the final part of that? Hopefully it's the same.
I think it's the same, but I think it depends on the time period. In my experience, things change more slowly than you either hope or expect, but they change more fundamentally than you hope or expect. So I hope and expect a more fundamental change, but I suspect it will be over a longer time period.
A big thanks to Stevie for coming on the show. You've been listening to Fundraising as a Female Founder with me, Alice Audley. If you have any questions, suggestions for future guests, or want to get in touch, please contact me through my new website, aliceaudley.com, or tweet me at Alice Audley. That's AUDLEY.